about the nature of change from the sort of from the Dharma perspective and how it relates to our, you know, our own situation. I think it's safe to say that our species, as we have come to evolve over the millennia, could be described as one that does not favor change, and yet at the same time thrives on it. So it's the challenge of change that continues to bring forth aspects of ourselves that we may not have known were there. Margaret Mead once observed that the only ones who really want change are babies with wet diapers. Find something genuinely unsatisfactory about their current situation. However, it also applies to, you know, oppressed peoples and others who from time to time foment revolutions and whatnot because they were more willing to die than they are to continue to live under the status quo. So we like stability. We like to be able to predict how things are going to be and keep them the same as a means of feeling secure and feeling, as if we belong here and that we can continue to exist without an inordinate amount of effort. And so as a result, we oftentimes try to create situations that seem to be immune to change, even though the change is manifesting all around us. So the Buddha, in talking about the, what he called the three torments of the mind, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion, in parallel with these sort of three conditions of existence, which are ceaseless change, impermanence, insubstantiality, okay, and ignorance. And what that third one is the mind's disinclination to see how everything is always in flux and how everything is always insubstantial. So, given his take on things, there is seems to be this inherent tendency within us to not want to see change that is obvious and unwanted until it's no longer possible to ignore it. And so as a current example, we find that to be the case with people living in coastal communities in storm-prone parts of the country. The sea level is rising and the high tides are higher and the storms are more frequent and they are more intense and they bring more precipitation and there is more destruction and there is more devastation and there is more dislocation than there has been in the past. And it's something we don't want to acknowledge. You know, in the forests of the Mountain West, and the West Coast, you know, climate is becoming drier, the forests are becoming more fire prone, the fires are more frequent and they're more intense and they're more destructive. Okay, each year sets the record for the worst wildfire in some western state or other. So these are changes that are underway, that are happening now, that we don't want to acknowledge, that we don't want to admit. And we also very much, there's a tremendous amount of resistance to acknowledging that those particular changes were caused by us. So it brings us to a kind of a consideration of the Buddha's take on change, and basically also the same for the Taoists and ancient China. There are three aspects to change as they are portrayed and woven into the Buddha's teachings and as they inform his teaching that are worthy of keeping in mind. The first is that change is cyclical. It's not a once-through phenomenon. That it is following a pattern or a circular cycle, just like the cycle of the seasons. You know, from one to the next, and all the indicators that we see in the natural world of when we are, in fact, shifting from one season to another. In addition to being cyclical, it is ceaseless. Okay. We have these conventions where we talk about the first day of winter, right? Well, it used to be fall, and now it's winter. we're one of the few countries in the world that calls the first day of winter the winter solstice. And much of the, certainly the Commonwealth world, the nations that were established by the English Empire. The understanding is that the beginning of summer, for instance, doesn't happen on the summer solstice. It happens about midway between the vernal equinox, the spring equinox, and the summer solstice. So when Shakespeare wrote his play called A Midsummer Night's Dream, it was about the summer solstice, right? So we like to divide up this cycle, okay? Now it's winter, now it's spring, now it's summer, now it's fall. But the whole time, it's just this ceaseless cycle, you know, with these incremental changes happening day by day by day. And we like to divvy it up, you know, so that we can assign some predictability to, well, now it's summer, now it's fall. Now this is supposed to happen, now that's supposed to happen. If you think about some of the architecture of the ancients, you know, whether it's the Kivas in Chaco Canyon or the monuments, the circular monuments within the Great Pyramids in Central America, or Stonehenge, you know, those are all basically observatories and giant clocks, because what the people who built them were trying to do was to impose some sense of certainty or normality or predictability upon the ceaseless change in the environment. All of those structures were lined up so that they would know exactly when summer solstice is going to be, and exactly when the autumnal equinox is going to be, and the winter solstice, and the vernal equinox. Because those points in time were really very much related to how they would go about surviving on the earth. You know, when was going to be the best time to plant a crop? When was going to be the best time to harvest a crop? When was going to be the best time to cut down trees for firewood? When was going to be the best time to stop doing that so there'd be some trees for next year? So they were trying to come into sync with these natural forces in order to increase the likelihood that they were going to make it through another year. So there was this ancient understanding, yep, it's going round and round and round, and it's absolutely unceasing. Nothing you can do to stop it. And then the third aspect is that it is lawful. And this is where there was kind of a, you know, in terms of social classifications, that there, and in all these, you know, whether it was the ancient Central American civilizations or the Celts or whoever, that there is this kind of breakdown between those who kind of really got it or understood what the nature of the cycles of the universe and the cosmos were, and those who were kind of clueless. because the ones who built Stonehenge and built the sun circles and, you know, the Kivas and Chaco and elsewhere, when they understood the nature of the alignment between how the universe works and human needs, they became very good at predicting. And so they could tell everybody else who was relatively clueless, you know, when this or that or the other thing ought to be done, and they would assign their rituals associated with that. And so they were seen to be these kind of fortune tellers, these people who could actually control change and make things be like we wanted them to be. So it was a source of tremendous power. Okay. Up to a point, you know, and because what's happened for us over the last few hundred years is that we have come to the point where we somehow or another got it in our heads that we could control change, you know, that we could slow it down, or that we could speed it up, or that we could direct it, or that we could bend the universe to our will in some way or another. And from the time of the Taoists forward to now, the Tao is sometimes called the way, sometimes it's referred to as natural law, the way things are. It's in Chinese Buddhism, it's pretty much synonymous with the Dharma, you know, the truth, the way, the how things are, you know, the nature of reality, right? And so for the ancient Taoists, as well, certainly for the Xuan Buddhists, the whole notion was to be able to discern what the nature of lawful change is. What are all the causes and conditions that give rise to change occurring when it does, you know. Not so that we can try to manipulate it or make it different, but so that we can live in harmony with it. So we can live in accordance with it. And the way the Buddha taught it, that very same aspiration or desire is equally true of the changes continuously underway within ourselves, that are of a cyclical nature, that are of a ceaseless nature, and that are of a lawful nature. Right? So when the Buddha taught insight meditation, it was an invitation to look at all the causes and conditions that have given rise to who we are in the moment. All these lawful influences that have come together at this point in time to bring what we call self, or what we call our being, into being. Right? First, just to understand how it works. Right? And then, if there are aspects of that coming into being, of the way we fabricate ourselves, that when we look at it, are not necessarily in keeping with the way. If there are, in fact, aspects of how these things are coming together that we are striving to change or make different in ways that are not in accordance with the laws of karma, that the result is to only cause more suffering. And so, if you look at some of the unintended consequences of doing things like building massive dams in the Amazon basin, you know, and the kind of economic and environmental devastation that those are wreaking, the same thing with, you know, the dams of the, you know, the Yellow River and the Great, you know, the Three Gorges Dam in China and whatnot. It was an effort to change the way nature functions in order to achieve a certain objective. But the cumulative effects of doing that are even now devastating, and when those structures fail, as they inevitably will, it's going to be payback time because of an inability to be able to see clearly the way nature works. And the Buddha said that's true for us as well. That what we need to do when we do insight practice is to look at the nature of the changes that make us who we are at this point in time. Look at the ways that we may be willfully ignorant of what some of the forces that make who we are at this point in time who we are. Some of the ways that out of aversion or clinging or ignorance that we try to pretend that things are not as they are. And that we try to be a way that's not in accordance with how things are. So sometimes practicing Buddha Dharma is described as getting out of your own way. That's just sort of awakening to ways that you may be making life harder for yourself than it needs to be, because you don't quite understand what the nature of your own will is, you know, of the way that you might be trying to influence change in a certain way. You know, so toward the end of our sitting, you know, I recited those phrases from the Tibetan book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo. And that's a book about change. In the Tibetan Buddhist understanding, the cyclical, ceaseless nature of life on earth for human beings is that we are continuously moving through these four stages. We are now, and Bardo basically means state of change, or realm of change, okay? So we are now living in the Bardo of being. And it seems to be stable and static and unchanging. And if we have been listening carefully to anything the Buddha had to say, as well as watching what's going on in our own minds and our own bodies, we know that that's not the case, right? The only constant in our being alive on this earth is change. We don't notice the rate of change, okay, but it's going on nonetheless. Toward the end of the Bardo of being comes the Bardo of dying. And that's that transition from one cycle to another, just like going from one season to another, you know, is what those phrases in the book are saying, you know. You, nobly born, you are the son or daughter of the Buddha. Remember who you are in these times of change. You know? Remember the Buddha who has taken birth in your very own form. Step out of the small self, this body of fear. And in this understanding, basically there are three bodies we simultaneously inhabit. One is the physical body, another is what we call the rainbow body, or the energetic aura that, you know, emanates from us. And the third is the great body of which we're all a part. So in this one, in that phrase, we're talking about this physical body. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they refer to it as the fear body, right? And the reason they do that is because the physical body, the fear body, is hardwired to not want to die. And when it looks as if that may be about to happen anyway, it engenders fear, let's say. So let's say, step out of the small self, this body of fear, this body that, in fact, is dying, right? Step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in generosity and kindness of heart. Those are aspects of the Brahmaviharas, right? The open-heartedness, the compassion, you know, the equanimity. Right? So it's basically inviting us to let go of the physical body and allow the consciousness to emanate into this more energetic body. And in fact, when the Buddha taught the Brahmaviharas, when he taught, you know, the cultivation of metta, of loving kindness and compassion and selfless joy and equanimity, the way he taught it was as an emanation. He said you project it into the four quarters, you project it above and below, you emanate it, you you share it, you know, with all living beings. And so that's what that phrase is, step out of the small self, this body of fear. Rest in generosity and kindness of heart. Rest in the dedication and the compassion and the equanimity that you share with all living beings. You know, just moving outward in all directions. For that is who you truly are. Trust it and rest in your own true nature. That's a description of change. When you're moving from the bardo of living to the bardo of dying, and then from there into the bardo of non-being. Okay. Being just kind of out there, sort of part of the universe, you know, part of the great light. Okay. And then, if there's still work to be done, it's the bardo of becoming. Okay. And so, birth is taken, and you come back around again in this cyclical pattern, right? And then here you are again. The bardo being. And part of waking up is realizing the cyclical and ceaseless nature of this process, and that it's all happening quite lawfully. Right? Just as we move from winter to spring to summer to fall, and just as, you know, we live under in this end of the world, and in this time of the year, we live more under the influence of the light of the moon, the reflected light, okay. And then in the summer we live more under the influence of the direct light. You know, it's all very cyclical. The trees out here know how it works. They've been doing it for several hundred million years, you know. the deciduous ones, you know, when to hibernate and when to wake up. So do the animal species, you know. And, you know, as best we can, we try to get the hang of it as well. And so all these wisdom traditions are trying to help us to live with these ceaseless cycles of lawful change and harmony in ways that respect the natural cycles so they can sustain us and support us. Because when we fail to do that, when we fail to understand how all this works, and we try to treat the world in ways that don't respect that, we only harm ourselves, right? So, and the Buddha said the same thing with regard to, you know, spiritual freedom. He said, as we gradually more and more begin to awaken to the nature of anicca, of impermanence, that's the Pali word for impermanence, ceaseless, cyclical, lawful changes, the better we come to understand how it works in nature, how it works in society, how it works in ourselves, okay. Then, among other things, it becomes possible to have a little more equanimity about whatever it is that we find is going on, so that even if we find ourselves in times where there's, you know, considerable environmental peril, as there is, or societal peril in terms of stresses and, you know, really destructive tendencies in the way we behave as a society and the way we behave in relationship to the environment, you know, in terms of greed, hate, and delusion, right? That all of those forces are playing out in lawful ways. And there will be lawful consequences attending upon those behaviors. They may not be the ones we would like to see. You know, what we try to do individually is to live with integrity and to live in harmony and to live in balance and to join together with others and seek to do the same thing. And if enough people are trying to do that with enough dedication and commitment, things may shift. But until they do, we will simply experience the lawful consequences of, as a society, not paying enough attention to the way that nature actually works. Okay. But It all starts with us. It all starts inside. It all starts with our own insights into who we are and how we are ceaselessly changing and how we are cyclically changing. And the forces of our own past karma that cause us to come together in the way we do. And the more insight we can gain into how that's happening, the more potential we have for not needing to repeat the behaviors that caused us and others suffering in the first place. And that's how, it's where insight comes to play in studying the nature of these changes. So, as we practice, whether it's on our own, in conversation with others in the broader society, the ability to see through the desired fantasy of stasis, of stability, of things always being the way we want them to be, not being subject to change. You know, it's like Greta Thunberg said, you know, when she was addressing the UN climate conference, you know, you speak of these fantasies and fairy tales of endless economic development, you know. She was naming delusion. You know, that's not how nature works. You're positing endless consumption of finite resources, you know. How dare you? That's not how nature works. That's not where the future lies for those of us who want to live and thrive in, you know, in future generations. So it was an exhortation to wake up, right? And that's what the Buddha's teachings are too. It's an exhortation in the same way, you know. They're, you know, just like she was saying, for all of us, we have our fantasies and fairy tales about, you know, how we want things to be, or how things should be, or how we should be, or how others should be, rather than being, you know, just sitting back and relaxing and trying to have a look at, well, how are things really, you know, what's really going on with me, you know, what's really driving, you know, how I speak and act during the course of a day. You know, are there things about that that need a closer look? You know, that I might be able to change for the better. So it's not as if we don't have a role to play in change. It's how we figure out how to change in ways that are sentient, that are responsive, you know, that are informed by our insights or our knowledge as to how we are and how the world is. So wise change is always a possibility. The Buddha taught that as well. We're not like doormats, you know, or, you know, when you said going with the flow, I think it was Sarah Palin or somebody, you know, said, oh yeah, go with the flow, that's what dead fish do, you know. It's like, of course, she was. She's not really a scholar of Eastern philosophy. I guess you could say that's not quite what the Taoists had in mind. You know? They're a little bit more like, you know, whitewater kayaking or something. You know, see how the flow is intended and figure out how best to navigate your way through it. You know, so, but that's what we're really trying to do too. But we can't. You can't skillfully navigate the white waters if we can't read the river, you know. So that's what coming into harmony with change is really mostly about. Just some thoughts. Anyone else have any thoughts they'd like to share? Any questions about the Buddha's teachings on anicca, about seasonality in our own heart minds? Oh, yeah, please.
When you say lawful, are you referring to natural law?
Yeah, just kind of the way things are, you know. I mean, we seem as a society right now to be doing everything we possibly can to revoke a couple of the laws of thermodynamics but somehow, you know, we haven't managed to get nature's attention yet. It looks as if those laws are not repealable. Seems to be how things are, right? Bummer, because we're boiling in our own oil as a result. But and when the Buddha would talk about natural law, he was talking about the law of karma. He was talking about how not only our own past actions, but all the things that have been done to us in the past, all the things we've experienced, how all of those come together to give rise, you know, to our past behaviors, to our current behaviors, genetic predisposition toward dependencies of one kind or another, all these things that kind of go together to result in who we happen to be at this point in time. That's what he's inviting us to kind of pay attention to.
So the Buddha recognized how we are a product of causes and conditions.
Yes.
And that we can interject change.
Yes.
Did he also acknowledge, or did he was he able to predict the extent to which human activity has altered natural law? Because it has to some extent.
Oh, absolutely it has. I'm not aware of teachings in which he did that explicitly with regard to the environment, but he definitely talked about how these forces of greed, hate, and delusion, if they manifest and they're energized and they're acted upon with regard to individual human behavior, can cause tremendous suffering. He was very explicit about the possibility of the same thing happening on a societal level.
I'm thinking, for example, the fact that natural phenomena like hurricanes and tornadoes are worse now because of the heating of the oceans, for example,
yes,
that are a result of our greed and delusion.
Yep. He didn't talk about hurricanes and things. He talked a lot about wars and social strife and things of that nature, that when the greed, hate, and delusion seize an entire society, just as they seize the mind of an individual person, that you can wreak untold havoc on entire societies by virtue of those tendencies of mind being acted upon. But I don't have knowledge of ways in which he talked about that wreaking environmental devastation. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Anything else? Okay, well then let's devote the rest of our time to celebrating in song some aspects of these teachings. Circularity. Cause and effect. And the rebirth of the sun.
Little
see the ice slowly melting. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been through. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right. New Year to one and all.
Thank you.